Welcome to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. I am your host, Steve Anderson, and today we have a great guest in Justin Moore. Dr. Moore is the Chief Executive Officer of the American Physical Therapy Association, the national membership organization representing and promoting the profession of physical therapy in the United States. APTA exists to further the physical therapy profession's role in the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of movement dysfunctions and the enhancement of the health and functional abilities of the public. Prior to being named CEO, Moore was APTA's Executive Vice President of Public Affairs. Before that, he served in several government affairs positions, including work as the association's lead lobbyist on Capitol Hill. Moore is a licensed physical therapist who received his Doctor of Physical Therapy degree from Simons College in Boston, Massachusetts, and his Master of Physical Therapy degree from the University of Iowa, and his Bachelor of Science degree in Dietetics from Iowa State University. Thank you, Justin. I really appreciate you being here today. What excites you most about being in a leadership position as the CEO of the American Physical Therapy Association?
I think the thing that excites me most is the constant learning that gets to happen, as I'm exposed not only to a wide variety of leaders, but a wide variety of projects and initiative. And so it's just something different all the time. So I'm in a constant state of learning and developing, observing, and that's just a natural part of the job and something that I get to do every day. So that's sort of what's most exciting.
And what's your biggest challenge in your current role?
People.
Yeah.
Just across the board. No, as I came into a leadership role, I always say it's the people, because I didn't realize how much you're dealing with people's real life. They obviously spend about a third of their day with you as a worker, but they're complex people who have a lot of issues in life that you're always dealing with a lot of interesting issues that make the human dynamic exciting. And people have lives, it's not just all about work, and so understanding them at that level, understanding them as a whole being, was a little bit shocking when I came into a leadership role, but something I'm starting to enjoy. It was a big challenge. I'm always dealing with the work's the easy part. Dealing with the human dynamic is what makes it complex, challenging, but also fun.
And as a leader, the more that you know about your people and what drives them and what they have going on in the rest of their lives, as you just mentioned, is a real skill. But you know, in the past, it's always been, well, you know, you don't want to get in people's personal lives, you don't want to know them too much. But yet, you make a great point. I think the more you know them, the more you know what they're going through, I think that makes you a more informed leader.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of integration, as I try to integrate all aspects of my life, whether it's spiritual, physical, well-being, and into my work, into my personal life. And so I think you have to approach the people you work with in a very integrated fashion and really try to understand them as a person and what makes them tick, what's going to make them feel fulfilled. But as we said, the human dynamic and the people are the most challenging. And part of that was scale. I used to know the 30 people I worked with for a decade well. And when you inherit 180 plus your board of directors in a bigger group, the volume and the scale of the number of issues you're dealing with just made it a lot more challenging than I was expecting.
Yeah, and then you've also got the big membership too. So people feel like they know you because you're up there, and they feel like they know you, and they come up to you and act like you're your friend. So that's a hard thing to maneuver too.
Yeah, my wife always tells the story that little things get me riled up, and I have no reaction to big things. So when you're dealing with a large scale of people and they have big issues going on in their life, I'm not the best at, it's sort of an area I'm working on. I'm not always the best at reacting, because big things sort of don't knock me off my stride, but losing my car keys will send me through the ceiling. So it's an interesting dynamic we've had board members with health issues, we've had staff members. Life is complex and dynamic, and dealing with those was a whole new challenge to a leadership position.
But isn't that a great trait of leadership, is being able to be calm and in control during those really tough situations, the bigger situations, as you say?
Yeah, and just trying to understand what they need from you as a leader during those situations. Because it's easy to lead when you're on a project and there's a defined objective. It's hard to lead when somebody just needs you to support them, give them space, and help them grow. And that's been a challenge. It's easy to lead on, we're both sports guys, but it's easy to lead when you're the field general, or easy to lead when you're the quarterback. Right. But it's harder to lead when, somebody's wanting you just to be an ear, wanting you just to be an arm to lean on. And I'm not the most, even though I'm a PT, I'm not the most hugger or personal approach. So that's always a challenge.
Yeah. Now, you've read lots of books and studied leadership, as I know. What do you feel is the key as someone evolves, someone evolving into a great leader?
Openness to learning. I think when I started, trying to discover who I was as a leader, I thought there would be, a book that would guide me the way. I thought there would be, some secret formula, some course you could take. And it's really an amalgam of all that. It's really bringing those all together and really constantly trying to figure out what has worked for other people, what are strategies, and then tailoring them for your own personality and your own approach.
Oh, wait a minute. You're the CEO. You don't know everything?
No. It's a constant learning environment. And I find it's sort of that classic line, the more you learn, the more you realize you don't know.
Yeah.
And so it's that vulnerability of really being sort of recognizing that you don't have all the answers. When I first came into the role as CEO, I told my executive staff we needed to embrace the gray. Yep. Most of us came from jobs that were very black and white. You go up and get a co-sponsor on a piece of legislation. There's sort of a defined outcome. You did it or you didn't. And the higher, you go up in an organization, or the more you're exposed to leadership, that you realize it's really all about the gray and embracing that gray between the black and white answers.
Now, I will tell you as a ex-CEO myself, that is such a key point. But you're pushed in a lot of ways not to think that way. People think you should think black and white. And sometimes, a lot of times, it is the gray. It is just, it depends. It's gray. It's, it can't always be black and white. And some people struggle with that.
Yeah, it's, I think, somebody could, give me criticism or make comments that at times I'm probably not the most decisive. But I think it's sort of understanding the nuance of the gray.
Right.
And that there's not a lot of easy answers. And there's not a lot of answers that you're not going to second guess. So it's sort of iterative all the time, evolutionary. And how do you sort of make a decision, observe it, and figure out how to learn from it? And we know that I tell young physical therapists or student physical therapists all the time, is this is natural for physical therapists. You try a treatment approach, you watch the patient, you see how they respond, and then you change. You keep doing it, and some things don't. And you got to be in that constant mode of discovery.
Yeah, I've told the story before, but if you don't mind, I'll tell it again. Right before I became the CEO of Therapeutic Associates, I was sitting in a room, and my predecessor was up in front of the room, and there was a big issue, and I can't remember exactly what it was, probably something to do with Medicare, more than likely. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, what are we gonna do? How are we gonna do this? This is dramatically gonna change our what we do in business, and how are we gonna do this? And then I thought to myself, oh, well, don't worry, because Warner will know what to do. And then it hit me like a ton of bricks that in 3 months, people are going to be looking at me and say, oh, well, Steve will know what to do. And we don't always know what to do. So that's that imposter syndrome of just being put in positions sometimes where you expected to know the answer. And quite frankly, we don't always know the answer.
Yeah, it's always it's easy to be the quarterback from the stands.
Exactly.
And, everyone's got an opinion on what, how I should have hit that open receiver. But until you're in the game and dealing with all the situations, it's not as obvious when you're in the situation.
Exactly. Now, as a CEO, we have discussed before this, but we talked about as a CEO, you always have this backpack on. So what does that mean to you, and what? How do you relate to that description?
It was a great description. You told me it was one of the key pieces of advice that you gave me when I transitioned into this role, is to realize you have it. And just that awareness that you're always on the job, was shocking. And on one hand, you sort of embrace the responsibility. On the other hand, it's sort of a burden that never leaves. It's always sort of weighing you down. So I've tried to embrace the backpack. I've tried to, figure out how I build a life of integration. And so knowing I'm going to have to be on, how do I incorporate that I'm not always thinking about the backpack, that I'm, but when I'm on vacation, I know I'm going to have to do a couple hours of work, even when I'm on vacation, and it doesn't bother me. I don't get sort of put off by that. I plan it. And I decide I'm going to do that so then I can enjoy and go on a hike with my kids, or I can go to the sporting event, or I can do that. So the backpack is a burden at times, but it also is enormously flexible because you can take it anywhere. So it's that, how do you respect it, but also embrace it?
And so by embracing it, as you say, so how do you balance expectations without burning out, but still spending time with your family, like we all say, we all want to do, and we all say we need to do?
Yeah, integration's the key. Is my kids love coming to the office. So there's times where I'm working and I'm getting quality time with them. I like to work out and run from that standpoint. At times I'll go for a run with a specific purpose of like, hey, I need to think about this project a little more and have some downtime where I'm not sort of grinding away, where I really sort of let my mind free up so I can think about different ways to approach a problem or a project. So I really focus on integration and trying to build build a life around the integration of my character, my personal goals, my family goals, my spiritual goals, my physical goals, and really try to integrate them and everything. So.
And I've had a lot of people say that, as leaders, we need to at times totally disconnect, totally, not look at your phone, totally not look at email, go on vacation, forget about everything and come back. I personally find that extremely hard to do, and it sounds like you do too. So you just have to embrace the fact that, not everyone has that luxury.
Yeah, and it's, there's a lot of, you hear about a lot in leadership about work-life balance. The only word that matters in that is balance.
Right.
If a lot of people use that word to separate work and life, and I believe they're tough to not have those be integrated, and that they're one and the same, and so they really focus on the balance so you don't burn yourself out. And I sort of worry about, and I think everyone who goes through this leadership, I sort of got over the imposter syndrome pretty quick. Because I figured I got to be learning all the time, and I'm never going to know all the answers. So if that was sort of a barrier, it was going to be tough. But I always struggle with the sustainability issue.
Yeah.
I worry about that much more than imposters. How do you sustain the pace? How do you sustain and make sure you have the balance? Because anyone can do something really hard for a short period of time, but can you sustain it and persevere over a long course?
Right. And I think the thing that always for me was that the human species has shown an unbelievable capacity to work very long and hard and do okay. But I think what burnout is when you're doing that, but you don't see the purpose in it, or you don't feel like you're making a difference and that type of thing. That's when you burn out.
Yep.
So I think as long as you can keep identifying, why am I doing this? What's the bigger goal? What's the bigger purpose? Who am I affecting beyond myself and so on? It makes it easier, but there's no question it's a tough thing to do. Do you feel judged sometimes about having the balance or not having the balance by others?
Or I think a lot of people have opinions on whether you have the balance or no, or not. I think a lot of people, it's always that saying that you never know what people are bringing with them to the job. You never know people's full life.
Yeah.
And so, but it's interesting in the job, a lot of people have opinions on how you conduct yourself, how you would try to achieve that balance. And, I'll hear comments, well, you work too hard, or you work too much, or you're not doing enough, you're not getting around the office enough to say hi, or, you'll hear those things. And you got to sort of get comfortable that you're always going to have that criticism, and you got to sort of build the balance and build the approach that works for you, because you got to sustain it. If you spend all your time doing one of those things, you wouldn't be good at something else.
So, exactly.
Yeah. So who do you admire great leaders and why?
On a very large scale, I sort of have the traditional you know, people out there that you really admire, you know, whether it's somebody like an Abraham Lincoln who, you know, if you read Book of Rivals, that, you know, you really see how he was able to maximize the talents of other people and build a team. And I think that's one of the hardest leadership traits you can ever do is how do you build a team? Yeah. It's sort of easy to be a personal leader and have a personal brand, but when you bring people along with you and build a team around you, that's a leadership skill that's hard.
But isn't that exactly a description of a leader is building other leaders?
Yep, exactly. And that's I think that's an underestimated part of leadership. Yeah. I think especially in today where it's easy to be a singular leader and have a brand on social media, have a brand on the stage, and really be a spokesperson. But that's not leadership to me. Leadership is when you really start to build a team. And it's probably not something that I'm really great at right now. It's something that I'm constantly trying to learn is how do I bring along you know, other people? Because when you're a lobbyist, when you're a wrestler, I have a lot of history of being an individual. And so being, you know, really sort of steeped in individualism from those backgrounds, understanding and building a team has been a challenge and something that is I'm trying to constantly learn. But I also have, I've been fortunate, I've been surrounded by a number of individuals that are much more personal leaders and people I admire. And that's yourself, Patrick and Drew, who, you know, sort of mentored me over a number of years. I think a lot of John Childs and the way he conducts himself and the way he operates as a leader, those are really people I see in the profession. And I've got some exposure to some of the CEOs of large companies and PTs, and a lot of them are great leaders. On a personal level, Mark Batterson, who's a Christian author and a friend who I really admire what he's built and how he conducts himself and how his leadership perspective. And then I was fortunate to get exposed to a gentleman at Iowa State University, Reed Crawford and Jeff Johnson, who are both were administrators at the university, and just charismatic leaders, thoughtful leaders that just really took me under their wing and just showed me how to learn, how to grow. So those are some of the...
It's so interesting when you ask that question or read biographies or whatever, most leaders can point back to some mentor, somebody early on that really made a difference to them. Mm-hmm. And I just think it speaks so much to when we help new professionals and help them into the profession and what a difference it makes. It makes a huge difference, whether it's, you know, high school age people, a college, new professionals in our profession, whatever. But that mentorship is really important.
Yeah, I grew up in a you know, rural town in Iowa, and there was an expectation you gave back to the community.
Yeah.
And that was just how it worked. You know, there were farmers, teachers, and clergy and some healthcare professionals. But it was and everybody sort of had an expectation that you led and you contributed. And I think just, you know, there were a lot of influences back from that home, you know, my hometown that, you know, inspired me, encouraged me to be a leader, and sort of thrusted me into leadership roles that I probably wasn't ready for, helped grow. So.
Yeah. You know, getting back to what you said earlier, you know, building leaders or connecting with people, you know, there's that bit that, you know, if you're authentic, people know it. And being a lobbyist, I know you've seen this, is a lot of times you'll talk to a politician and you'll be getting kind of a personal engagement, and then all of a sudden you'll just see their eyes click and then they go into the... you know, and what do you call it? Into the on point thing,
yeah,
right?
Stump,
you know,
speech.
Exactly.
Yeah, the
and
talking points.
And so it's true that you can't fool, you know, people that when you're leading them that you can't just go into the stump speech, you know, every time. Oh, you know, and you just go in. And I do think that people, as you described earlier, some of them are performers, and some of them can do that really well. Mm-hmm. But on a personal level, I think people feel that.
Yeah, some of the most authentic leaders I have ever met and been exposed to have been politicians.
Yeah.
And I know that probably seems like a paradox or, you know, I think it's why they're good at it is they know who they are and they're on a public stage all the time and they've got to be very comfortable with their leadership style because in any day, half the people disagree with them.
Yeah.
And so some of the most, I've also probably experienced some of the most inauthentic leaders too, but for the most part, people who choose public service have honorable intent and really seek to make a difference. And most of them come from a really good place. And politically, you might disagree with them.
Right.
And actually, some of them you disagree with the most are some of the ones you end up respecting the most. Because they just have a different vantage point, and you came to understand that. So,
can I put you on the spot and ask you who comes to mind when you describe that person?
I think Senator Jerry Moran, who I developed a relationship with for a number of years, is an authentic leader.
Yeah.
You know, he's a senator from Kansas. I first worked with him when he was the VA subcommittee chair in the House of Representatives. Mm-hmm. So a B committee, as they call him on the Hill. The ranking member, so not even in the majority at that point, and got to know him and developed he just asked good questions.
Yeah.
He wanted to understand the issue before he committed to a position. And as a somebody in politics, that was interesting. He really wanted to understand the issue. And I just sort of, it was early in my career, and I thought, they just wanted the talking points. And they had sort of already made up their mind where they were going to be at on the issue.
Yeah.
And it was a good exposure I had to him early on. And he probably jumps out the most.
Yeah.
Blanche Lincoln is another one.
Yeah,
just because she's, Lincoln. She's been out of the Senate since she was defeated in 2010. But it was just a, great leader from a standpoint of inspiring, charismatic. And really, you just felt like you wanted her on your side.
Yeah.
You wanted her to be your neighbor. You wanted her to be your senator. You wanted her to really be on your side of the equation.
So I remember personal experience with that at a dinner one night. I got to sit right next to her over dinner. And it was very shortly. She was just kind of a friend to somebody you were talking to. You heard about her kids. You heard about her husband.
Yeah.
It was just like, wow, this is really cool. And it's nice to see that.
Yeah, I remember standing at National Airport at, 11:30 at night on a Sunday night after we'd been back on a trip, and Connor, my son, was probably 18 months old and in a stroller.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I'm like, who is this lady halfway in the stroller talking to our 18-year-old kid? And it was Senator 18 months.
Yeah.
Been a little weird 18 years, but 18, and it was Senator Lincoln.
Yeah.
And you're just like, who does that? And she was that type of leader, that type of person.
She was awesome.
Do you know what she's doing now? Is she back?
She's here in D.C., so she does some policy consulting.
Okay.
and does a lot, to support causes that she believes in.
Yeah.
And so she's in D.C., and
that's great.
Still a contributor and big public servant. So.
So if we can agree that we learn more from our failures than our successes, share with us one of your biggest failures and what you learned from it.
One of my biggest failures.
Yeah, it's putting you on the spot.
Yeah, I've been a pretty safe and conservative person, and so I've been here at APTA for 20 years.
Yeah.
So it's my second job. I was a staff physical therapist in a hospital, so I really haven't had any career failures. I've had some personal failures that have taught me a lot, and so not to go into detail, but just a lot of struggles on personal levels that I've had to really try to dig deep and learn more about, and and make changes. And really change the person I wanted to be, and work from that. And I think probably the best one, and not to get into great details, but I don't drink anymore, and haven't for 6 years. And part of that was a lifestyle change, because I started recognizing it was difficult for me to manage, and so just chose from a healthy lifestyle and approach that it was going to be more consistent with my character and my values. Mm-hmm. If I chose not to do that. I might do again, but at that time it worked, and it was a tough, just recognizing it was a failure that I couldn't manage it the way I was comfortable with.
Yeah, and that's very admirable. I mean, that's a hard thing to change.
Yeah.
So especially in today's world, and even in your position where you're expected to socialize.
Yeah. And that was probably why I did it is, when you're a lobbyist and a person, you're never, 2 feet away from social opportunity.
And a free drink.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
And you can gain 30 pounds in about 2 weeks at receptions here on Capitol Hill. So
the first time you applied for a CEO position, mm-hmm. you were not selected for that mm-hmm. position. And how do you stay positive in that scenario and continue striving for your goal?
Well, that was the, when you first asked the last question on what was a failure, that was one that I think about a lot is, you know, I wasn't successful when I applied the first time for the job. And, you know, in all ironies is, I think I learned through that process. Mm-hmm. And, but it took, I had to give myself time. I had to give myself time to be angry. I had to give myself time to be, I joked, I said, I heard things about myself that I wouldn't have liked myself. Yeah. During that process. So just getting comfortable that people had motive and said some things that were hurtful and so it was a growing process. Yeah. I did have to give myself space to not publicly be angry or be upset. Right. And through that process, I learned a trait I've never had, and that's patience.
Yeah.
I was a wrestler, and so wrestling is defined in high school anyway as 6 minutes of athletic activity. You don't wait for it to hang. If you're not you know, on your toes and stuff, you're going to be on your back.
Yeah.
And so it's so I approached life like a wrestler, and the only thing that's probably a little more intense as a wrestler is a bull rider. You know, he's got 8 seconds. I had 6 minutes. So So in that, I always approached that. And when I went through that process and was not selected, I had to really sit back, say, why wasn't I successful, do a lot of self-reflection, and demonstrate patience. And then go and just do my job and be a contributor. You know, I could have left APTA, I could have done a number of different things, and I chose to stick with it and learn, and I think it afforded me a great growth opportunity. And I had a colleague in town, he's now a very high-level CEO at one of the large trade associations, who told me, use the opportunity to learn. And he goes, you'll find out who your true friends are,
yeah.
You'll find out who you truly are, and you'll find out what really matters to you. And so I sort of got comfortable that being a CEO was never in my future. And I was sort of a public affairs person, and that's where I was. And then, you know, 3 years later, another turn happened, and the job came back, and I've had to learn how to do that.
Well, so. that's a great great advice. Have you told that person how valuable that advice was?
Yeah.
That's good. Because
yeah. It was just very funny. He said, yeah, and he's been very successful. He's probably one of the top CEOs in town, now running a large trade group. But he, which of all interest for the PTs that listen to your podcast, one of his first jobs in town was with the contract firm that represented PPS.
Oh, interesting.
So one of his first jobs was representing physical therapists in private practice, yeah. And now he's one of the more successful healthcare lobbyists in town, now a CEO of probably the largest healthcare trade group. But he didn't get a couple jobs early in his career as well, and he said they ended up being the best learning opportunities and successes of his life.
It's hard not to just get into that, it's all about me, and realize there's a bigger picture and that you can, you know, learn from that and grow from that and whatever. So that,
yeah, and you know, I also was, because I worked in politics, I also had I always joke, I've developed thick skin. I still have pretty thin skin, but I saw macro politics and how divisive it can be and how unauthentic it can be. And when the small pond politics, as they called it, you know, that's the big politics. When the small pond politics, I didn't have the interest in it or willingness to engage because I just saw it for what it was worth.
Yeah, so. Interesting.
You know, you have a very interesting oversight structure to deal with in this position. I mean, you're evaluated and basically supervised, I guess you'd call it, by an elected president. You have an elected board of directors that changes all the time. Mm-hmm. You have 100,000 members to keep happy. How do you keep all those balls in the air?
It's tough. It's again, going back to the theme, it provides a great opportunity to learn, because you're not working for one leader, you're working for multiple leaders.
Yeah.
And you have to develop a style that's transferable. And so I have a great opportunity, and I've had, yes, which leaders I admire. I have the utmost respect and admiration for two leaders that I've got to work under, and that is Sharon, APTA President Sharon Dunn, who might be the most authentic servant leader I've ever worked with. She's just a fabulous individual character, passion and really can lead. And Lisa Saladin, who is another just fantastic leader of strong, you know, intellect, and again, character, purpose. And they really have probably molded me more than I even realize. And I have just learned a ton from them. But I also recognized very early that I'm not going to have the opportunity to always work for them.
Yeah.
So I had to develop a style that was going to be open to other leaders and how they approach a job. Because in this job, if you're going to sustain it, you have to be comfortable that you're going to get new personalities, new leaders, and you have to develop a style that you can be authentic with them, but also learn from them and change your style to what works for them. So, you know, it is, I have a lot of bosses, and that's fun, but also a challenge. I got to remember sometimes which hat I have on and whether I'm dealing with, you know, my staff who are great leaders in their own respect, board members who have a very distinct and fiduciary leadership responsibility, or our members who just care an awful lot, which is key. We have one of the best memberships. I mean, they don't, this is not a profession for, this is a calling for many of them.
No, I bring it up because I do think that maybe a lot of people don't understand how different that is from a typical business perspective, you know, in the sense where, you know, you're just, you know, you may have a board of director or chairman of the board that you answer to, and beyond that, you know, that you do your job. But I think yours is unique in that.
Yeah, it's also, it's much more administration and manager than leader. If you take that triangle of those three roles, I have to be a leader with staff, and I have to be a leader in the Alexandria community, and really the face of APTA to those audiences. But when we're in member audiences, I'm a manager. I am, you know, I am not the leader of the organization to our members. That's our elected leaders. And, you know, and then even in the Hill, and, you know, I take on much more of a spokesman role then. And I might not be the policy leader, because we have a staff person that does that. But then I do have a spokesman role. So recognizing those different hats and being able to change them at the right time has become a skill that I'm learning. But it's also, I don't have a traditional leadership role. When I say something that doesn't naturally go into, you know, it's not a directive. It's almost everything we're doing is winning hearts and minds and creating a culture, and there's not a lot of directives. And that's good. And but all every once in a while you want to say, why should we do this? But we should just do it.
Well, so, you know, speaking of culture, you know, in the business world, culture is written and discussed a lot. When a CEO comes into a new position, like you did, you may not inherit the culture you desire. There may be some things you want to change. So what have you learned about culture, and how can you influence that in the bigger goal?
The first thing I've learned is you got to have perseverance and consistency. And so when you decide you're going to take on a culture change project, which this job was, and you know, if there was one thing, you know, when I came into the CEO, and when there's a change in leadership and traditional fashion, it's because there's an economic crisis and you need to turn the place around.
Right.
There's a ethical crisis, and so somebody is inconsistent with the values of the organization. Character crisis, to, you know, ethical character, or it's a cultural crisis.
Right.
And I really assessed the job, and this was my assessment. No one said this, that we were in a cultural crisis. And so how do we, and I recognized that I was, that was going to take 3 to 5 years to change.
Yeah.
And so how do you really invest that long view and really attack the culture and make sure that you're constantly thinking about it in all you do? There's no simple answer to changing an employee policy. There's no what you decide if you're, you know, letting one staff person do something versus another. All that contributes to this collectiveness known as your culture. And I think people approach culture all too often as torched earth. Yeah. They're going to come in, they're going to light a match, and it's going to, you know, going to change. And I came from, you know, as I said a couple times, rural Iowa. I call it, it's a slow burn.
Right.
And you don't burn a field and then torch the barn and the field and the forest, all that. You have to control the burn. And you have to be able to plan a few months later. And so you got to slow burn and make change at the right pace and at the right sequence. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to plan again.
See, you do know patience. You're talking about patience here. That's amazing.
Yeah, so I believe in the slow burn philosophy of cultural change, not the torched earth.
So. Yeah, that's great. Now, you've been CEO of APTA now for going on 3 years, right? So far in your tenure, what could you say if you can share with us. What's been a high point and what's been a low point?
Yeah, I think the high point has been the people. We started with that. I sort of focused and have lived 20 years in D.C. on being a creature of the advocacy community and the policy community. So when I came into the CEO position, and I think staff would tell you that I'm not here enough, but I had to really invest in getting to know the staff and getting to know the culture of the people we wanted to to encourage and empower. And so I think that's been the biggest success and the biggest rewarding part of the job is really focusing on the staff community and building programs that are going to help them be the best that they can be, because that's what everybody wants. Everybody wants to be the best version of themselves. And so I have a distinct responsibility to those 170 staff to help them grow, help them develop. And we've done a number of initiatives that have just really been fulfilling. I think the biggest disappointment, that's tough. I think our, gosh, I'm trying to think what, there's been plenty of disappointments.
I'm not going to answer the question for you, but it's probably the reverse of that. You know, some people can go with that change and go with that new look and whatever, and then some people just dig in their heels and kind of like, gosh, I don't know if I can go there.
I think the biggest disappointment is a lack of trust of intent. And that's sort of esoteric a little bit, but when people assign motives to what you're doing that don't exist and constantly have to battle that static, that's disappointing.
Yeah.
And I think it's also disappointing when people can't see beyond their individual needs for the organizational needs. And we see that from a number of constituencies who can't see the bigger picture.
Right.
And so you just sort of got to keep that in front of your mind that you can be sensitive to their needs, their individual needs, but you got to do what's best for the organization.
Well, kind of perfect lead into my next question is, how do you and your staff handle members in this environment that we're in with their strong political positions when you need to work both sides of the aisle to get our PT issues through Congress? That's got to be a challenge.
Yeah, we are political party agnostic. We're PT pro. And so it's, I don't care if somebody's a Democrat or a Republican, if they're pro PT, that's our goal. But it does take a unique ability to try to understand how our priorities fit with different perspectives. And so there's a constant attention to really understanding that, that people are going to have different perspectives. We have that in PT with different treatment approaches. Yeah. And so it's respecting that they have an individual perspective and building, some balance that we can respect each other, but we have to do what's in the best common good. And that's a constant struggle. The joke was early on that, I was a pinata. People were going to keep beating me until they got their piece of candy, after you realize that if you listen and you try to understand something, you might not be able to give them what they want, or you won't conform to their view. But if you understand it, you'll probably come up with a better perspective at the end of the day, anyway.
So. Yeah. And just from a personal perspective, I know me personally that you work so hard to build that relationship and you finally get it going and you got this relationship and then they're gone.
Yeah.
It's like, start over. Correct. That's hard to do.
It is. It's a constant process, and that's relationship building.
Exactly.
I mean, we have, and PTs have this in spades, is, we're a relationship business. We build those with patients, and so some of it comes naturally, but there's also an enormous cost of that investment in people, and that is rewarding as anything you'll ever do. But sometimes you just get to where you think you got a great relationship, and then one issue can blow it apart, and you got to start over and rebuild that capital.
A new professional asked me recently, came on as a key contact, and said, I want to do this because I want to help, but I don't know anything about advocacy, and I don't know how to do this. What do I do? And I go, well, you're a physical therapist, right? And they go, yes. I said, you know how to build relationships with your patients, right? And they go, yes. Well, you just need to build a relationship with a politician. And talk about what? Talk about whatever. Just build a relationship, and that's what it's about. So.
Well, when it comes out of some leadership book is, it's the concept of deposits. And you got to constantly depositing more than you're withdrawing.
Yeah.
And that's relationship, you know, and you know, and politics teaches you a lot about that. I mean, we were asking is when one of the politicians that I had been members of Congress I had worked with and been it was originally how I got involved in APTA was key contact to this individual, became chairman of the committee.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then he didn't, you know, he was not there for us on a key vote.
Yeah.
And I remember being disappointed. I'm, you know, 15 years of investment, and I wanted to withdraw, and my withdrawal didn't happen. And it took me, you know, I was disappointed, and I thought the relationship was a strained relationship.
Yeah.
And we're rebuilding that and back in that capital because, you know, we came down to, you know, 15 years of support and 15 years of working with them, and I needed them on one vote, and it wasn't there. and I had to get comfortable that, you know, okay, now back to square one.
That is really hard. Now, you and your staff have an exciting move coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So can you just tell us what that is, and how do you prepare the staff and the membership for a big change like that?
Yeah, it's very exciting. As most people have probably heard, APTA has lived in Alexandria, Virginia, since the early 1980s, and we're very fortunate to have board members who made, at the time of 1981 to 83, made great decisions to buy three properties. Those properties, we were getting ready to look at renovating them, and an opportunity came to purchase land and build a new headquarters. And so we'll be doing that over the next 2 years. We'll break ground in January and open the new building in our centennial year in 2021. But what's been most exciting about that and has been the opportunity to build a facility that'll showcase the profession, help connect us to our community, both locally in Alexandria or to our members in APTA, and really show be a manifestation of the profession.
Yeah.
So we're trying to create a fit building, one that's fit well certified, and really creates a dynamic workforce so that our employees are healthy, productive, and create the type of work environment that hopefully will be a model for other employers. So we just don't want to do the work of APTA. We want APTA to be an example of how work can be done in a healthy, productive way. So it's a huge opportunity to align to our mission and sort of be mission focused in a facility. And that's been really exciting from a design aspect and really creating a new environment. The downside or the other side of the coin on that is we're learning a lot about change management. And I'm not sure I knew what that word meant until the last 6 months, but we're learning a lot about how to build a process for change management, and that it's not going to be a physical move. It's going to be an emotional move for individuals. It's going to be a change in work style, and we have to give people space and time to really adjust, to learn, to be part of the process and help make decisions, help inform decisions. And so in July of this year, we kicked off a campaign, which is going to be a 3.5-year change management campaign, where we're working with our staff, and we call it Community APTA, and it's really focused on the 170. And I'm almost as excited about the change management initiative of the next 3 years of going and things in, you know, that are emerging is, can we go to a paperless office or a paper light office? Well, that's a decision that needs to be made by 180 staff, not two staff in a directive mode talked about. And how do you build that? What does that mean? And that change management process has really been fun to engage in. And a great leadership story is we sort of were worried about it, worried about how staff were going to receive it when we did it. And we hired a consultant, and we had staff participate in this writing the future of tomorrow exercise.
Mm-hmm.
And they knocked it out of the water. It was the most entertaining. They came up with ideas that we had never thought of. And when you empower people through that change management, and they did skits to demonstrate their new ideas, and we had some hidden talents on staff.
It was exciting.
Yeah, I think you're really smart to do two things. I heard what you just say. One is realizing that different people will make that mindset change at different times. So you need to give them the space and the time for them to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really smart. And then the other thing is you just said, include as many people as you can, because when they create something, then they buy into it and they're part of it. So it's
it's a great leadership lesson on how do you build ownership.
Yeah.
And how do you make people stakeholders? And you know, companies have used those words, but if you're not authentic to those words, if you're not, if you can make people owners and stakeholders, they're going to feel like they're contributing.
Yeah, yeah. So you might have answered some of this already, but I'll ask it in a little different way. So not from a PT policy or issue perspective, but more from a leadership perspective of running this organization, what is your vision over the next 5 years? Now, you said over the next 2 years you're going to do this, you know, move and go forward, but what's over the next 5 years? What's beyond that?
I think in a very general standpoint, we want APTA to be fit for a purpose. We want this organization to be a high-performing, data-driven organization that really is a leader and best in practice in associations and healthcare and relevant in serving our members. And so how do we build an organization that's fit for that purpose? We all know that the demographics of our membership, the demographic of the consumers are changing, and how do we evolve this organization to be relevant and be impactful to the next generation? Because it won't be, it's that famous commercial in the 1980s, it won't be your father's Oldsmobile.
Right.
That's a tough transition, but associations, core businesses have changed over the last decade.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it used to be all about the journal and publications. Those are still vastly important and in our part, but the delivery mechanism is totally different. You know, with electronics, we just had a meeting yesterday about the digital transformation strategy.
Yeah.
How do we protect our digital assets? And how do we make those accessible and valuable to the members who need them? And at the end of the day, we want APTA, our vision for APTA is it makes every PT a better clinician, a better researcher, a better educator, and a better person.
Yeah.
And so really embracing those core values and really being authentic to them over time.
It's so true. I remember near the end of my tenure as CEO, I kept saying we need to continue to build this company for the millennial and after generations, not the baby boomer generation, because it's a bigger sector of the population now. It's coming, it's evolving, it's, you're going to grow in certain ways. So it takes a visionary to think ahead about that and say, okay, these are kind of things that we need to think about, because what may be really great right now could be old school in two or 3 years.
And we look at that from a workforce issue too on our staff. How do we hire and how are we attractive to the new level of professionals who do media, who do communications and PR, who are lobbyists? Because for APTA to be relevant, we have to be hiring at a strategic level to bring on new talents that are going to position the association for its new reality.
So. Yeah, that's great. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you about today. So you have, you're a physical therapist, but you have a non-traditional role in physical therapy today. So what advice would you give new professional PTs about finding leadership roles in healthcare outside of your typical treating patient PT role?
Yeah, I think never lose the fact that you're a clinician, because there's two things that being a clinician and a physical therapist make you valuable to leadership, and that's the power of observation. I remember my first day in a clinical, and it was my clinical instructor said, don't ever waste the opportunity to watch the patient walk to your clinic or walk to your treatment room. And I said, why? And he said, because you'll learn more about that than you will anything. So make sure you're observing your patient. And because they might tell you something hurts, but you'll pick up on how they're walking and how they're moving. And if you use that power of observation, well, that's very transferable to leadership. If you're aware of your surroundings and observing what's going on, you're going to make good decisions and you're going to be in tune to what's going on and what's going to make an impact. So I think that's so never lose that clinical and in clinical problem solving. Diagnosing the problem, developing a treatment plan, and deploying those interventions is transferable to leadership. And we learn that as PTs. And so my first piece of advice is you can leverage your clinical skills in a lot of leadership opportunities. My second piece of advice is don't draw the boundaries of your picture too early.
Yeah.
So keep the don't frame it in right away. Because what might be an 8x10 at age 30 is going to be a 20 by 30 at age 40, and you don't know where this world's going to take you or what opportunities are going to be presented into you. And no one, there are very few people that, you know, wake up at 65 and said, I had my career path mapped out.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a straight path, and be open to those opportunities. I mentioned it earlier in the interview, I'm a pretty conservative and personality and pretty not very risk. You know, I'm not jumping off bridges and rock climbing, and I'm a pretty risk-averse person. But I took a risk really early that it's sort of shocking. I moved to Washington, D.C. with 2 years of clinical training for a job that paid less, required more hours, and was, you know, halfway across the country from my family. And I don't know why I did it. I was 29 years old and I did it, and it, you know, 20 years later, it's why I'm still here. You know, I was in Kalamazoo, Michigan, treating patients, and came out here for an interview on December 22nd, and by January, I was, you know, on the government affairs staff. And I'm not a risk person, so I never would have thought that would have worked, but be open to those opportunities, because...
Yeah, it's interesting. And Daniel Pink and I were just talking in a previous interview about how sometimes you just need to move. It's kind of that shoot and then aim type of thing. You don't know where it's going, but you just keep moving. You keep going in that direction.
Yeah, I laugh. It's Justin Timberlake, the great philosopher, you know, once said, the grass is not always greener. It's green where you water it.
Exactly.
And so it's the grass isn't always greener somewhere else. It's green where you water it. And so take advantage of the opportunities you have in front of you and be the best in those situations. You might not think you're leading as a staff PT, but you are. You're leading to that patient. You're leading to that caregiver.
Leading every level.
Exactly. And so water the grass where you're at.
No, so true. And I think we both would admit that neither of us thought we would be in a CEO position when we started in those early years. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't on the radar.
Yeah.
And it just kind of evolves into that.
You know, one of the great, my wife always tells me, and who is also a great leader and somebody I look up to a great deal, has a very successful career. She always says she's always shocked at how misunderstood I am. And one of the great misunderstandings is that I always wanted this job.
Yeah.
And I always thought I could do it. I think that was a little naive, to be honest.
Yeah.
But one of the things that it was never part of my career path to be CEO of APTA. But it's been a great opportunity and something I've enjoyed learning how to do.
But you will admit you had the drive and the fortitude to keep going and keep moving forward and keep doing that, which evolves into it.
I think the bigger drive was I thought I could make a difference.
Yeah.
I don't think titles had never been big to me, right. But I did think if I was in that position, I could make a difference. And I felt like I had a lot of ideas that I wanted to test out and try, and that was the best place to do it. So that was more the ambition than, you know, sort of being in the, I have one of the best offices in Washington, D.C., and I'm never in it. And I always say that it's going to make somebody a great apartment someday, and they should enjoy it, but it is a beautiful office. But if it was striving for that office, I wouldn't have been successful.
You don't build relationships behind a computer screen, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So kind of at this point in the interview, as we're winding down here, Justin, we usually do a pearl of wisdom relating to leadership. So if you could give our listeners a pearl of wisdom through your experiences, what would that be?
My biggest wisdom is make a commitment and stick to it. I think it's such an easy thing to say, I'm going to start something or I'm going to develop something and you work hard at it for 18 months and then sort of say, it's not working, go away. I'm a big fan that you just stick with it and preserve and persevere. I think that's been a big part of my leadership is looking at the long horizon and sticking with it. Because nothing that happens fast or easy is gonna stick. And so you got to be able to, even if you have instant success, to make that sustainable, you're going to have to preserve over a long time. And I think we look too much for instant gratification, instant feedback, instant success. And it's those small steps. It's the plotters.
Yeah.
It's not that you got to plot along and make sure that it's 2 steps forward and not, two steps back.
So. It's great. It's, as you said, resiliency, persistency, and then, as you said earlier, patience.
Yeah, I think a lot of us get that from, running.
Yeah.
If you're a runner, you kind of know that. You got to sort of, you start, it's one foot in front of the other. and you just got to keep doing it. And at some point, then you get the reward of the satisfaction. But it's not fun at times, and it's you know, constant attention to keeping on the straight path. It's keeping on the same path.
Well, thanks, Justin. This has been a really insightful discussion. I really appreciate your time, and thanks for talking with us today.
It's fun.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Profiles in Leadership. If you'd like to look at our entire gallery of videos, please go to YouTube and search under Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson. You can also go to my website, orange.coaching.com, and you can also listen to these interviews on the podcast through iTunes Podcast. Just search Profiles in Leadership with Steve Anderson.